National Archives podcast series, an overview of newly released files from 1982 with Mark Dunton and Simon Demasi, contemporary record specialists at the National Archives. Simon, if I can come to you first, could you give us an indication of what's being released this new year?
Certainly. As anyone would predict, the vast majority of the files that of primary interest released this year relate to the Falklands conflict. Amongst the Prime Minister's Office files alone, we have 41, not to mention almost a whole series of Foreign and Commonwealth Office files, and indeed military files as well from the Ministry of Defence and the various armed services. So obviously the Falklands being a huge event during the year means that that's reflected in this file release. There are plenty of other interesting files as well, as usual, indicating UK government's interest in other world affairs and, of course, economic policy, unemployment issues and various other domestic aspects. And, I think that the Falklands aspect is, of course, of primary interest, and I think it's probably somewhere where we should start.
And Mark, among the key sets of files released this year are the papers of evidence given to the Franks inquiry into the Falklands War, including Mrs. Thatcher's oral testimony, which was given behind closed doors. Mm. What do we learn from that?
Mm. Well, it's a very powerful testimony from Margaret Thatcher. We really do hear the authentic voice of Mrs. Thatcher, and you can tell when you read this evidence, which, as you say, has never been in the public domain before. You can tell that there's a great deal of feeling behind it. For example, Mrs. Thatcher states, "I never, never expected the Argentines to invade the Falklands head-on. It was such a stupid thing to do, as events happened, such a stupid thing even to contemplate doing." And you can tell, with all those repeated phrases, there's a sort of forcefulness there. She's being quizzed about that area because the Franks Committee is exploring that whole issue of whether or not she had prior knowledge about the invasion, you know, several weeks before it happened, which was an allegation that some people were making at the time, that she'd had a warning of at least a few weeks and that she deliberately kept that to herself so that she could then glory in the sort of retaking of the islands, you know. This question is put to her, but she's absolutely adamant, you know, and the evidence does back this up, that she had no knowledge, really, of the Argentine intention to invade until the crucial date of the 31st of March, which is when the Raw Intelligence reports came in that an Argentine fleet was massing and it looked like an invasion of the Falkland Islands was imminent. And that night, she was at the House of Commons, and the news was brought to her, I think, by John Knott, the Defence Secretary. And again, in this document, which references CAB 292/47, she states that it was the worst, I think, moment of my life. And in that comment, she's referring to that very moment when she got the news of those Raw Intelligence reports. And that in itself is a very powerful statement. She also states that night, no one could tell me whether we could retake the Falklands. No one. We did not know. We did not know. And again, it's Mrs. Thatcher speaking with total conviction that we hear.
And how did news of the invasion filter through from the Falkland Islands themselves?
There's another file, Foreign and Commonwealth Office file, FCO7/4490, and it really does tell the story of the Argentine invasion of the Falkland Islands through a whole series of telegrams, which are very dramatic. You know, the first telegram sent on the 31st of March, these are telegrams going from Lord Carrington, the Foreign Secretary, to Rex Hunt, the Governor of the Falkland Islands. And at first, he's being warned, Rex Hunt is being warned of Argentine preparations. You know, there seems to be a force at sea. But, you know, at first it's stated, we have no definite indication as to Argentine intentions. But then, you know, as time goes on, the stakes get higher and the tension rises, and Rex Hunt asks, you know, should I now inform the civilian population? And still, even on the 1st of April, Carrington is saying, well, the evidence isn't completely conclusive about the Argentine intentions. The British embassy at Buenos Aires suddenly telegrams to say that we've already started destruction of all sensitive material prior to 1981. Then, you know, then it becomes very clear that an Argentine task force is going to be arriving early on the morning of the 2nd of April. And Carrington states to Rex Hunt, you may wish to make your dispositions accordingly. And the very last telegram that's sent on the 2nd of April from Carrington says, you have discretion from me and the Defence Secretary to blow up the airstrip if you can. He means the airstrip at Port Stanley. But in fact, there's a written note on that telegram stating that the telegram was never actually received.
And one of the themes running through the files is the British government's preoccupation with preventing further Exocet missiles finding their way to Argentina. What do we learn from the files about that particular subject?
Yes, one of the key documents is a telegram sent by Margaret Thatcher to President Mitterrand, very much a sort of personal appeal. I think it's dated early May, and it can be found in Prem 19/649. And essentially, Mrs. Thatcher is really urging President Mitterrand to try and prevent Exocet missiles leaving France, you know, being passed on to Peru. You see, there was this private contract. The firm that made the Exocets had agreed to sell these Exocets to Peru, and there was a big worry on Mrs. Thatcher's part that the missiles would almost inevitably pass on from Peru to Argentina and could be used against British forces. And in fact, President Mitterrand had said he had little faith in Peru holding to the agreement whereby you don't pass missiles on to a third party. So Mrs. Thatcher, she uses very, it's almost Churchillian, the sort of language she uses, to paraphrase it a little. She says something like, I must urge you with all the power and urgency at my command, or some words to those effect, to try and prevent these missiles leaving. And she said, you know, if these missiles were passed on to Peru, the effect could be devastating for our relationship, the United Kingdom and France relationship, and devastating for the alliance. So she's saying the stakes are very high. She is putting pressure on. And I think it worked because, to the best of our knowledge, no missiles did in fact leave France for Peru while the conflict was running.
And Mark, what do we learn from the files themselves about Mrs. Thatcher's style of leadership during the conflict?
What you won't find in these files is a whole stream of memos from Mrs. Thatcher telling the service chiefs what to do. But what you will find is volume after volume of War Cabinet and wider Cabinet meetings, minutes of meetings, showing collective decision-making with Mrs. Thatcher firmly in the chair and, you know, giving decisive leadership. But, you know, there's a lot of evidence that Mrs. Thatcher listened to expert advice and took that advice and acted upon it. And if the chiefs of staff stated that a particular ship was a threat to a Royal Navy ship, then for her it was clear-cut. She would act on it. You know, that's one thing that we learned from the files.
And as Simon has said, the Falklands crisis came to dominate that year, 1982. In your view, what effect did they have on Mrs. Thatcher's premiership as a whole? Was it a turning point?
Yes, you're right to call it a turning point. It really was a watershed event, and fantastic that these files are being released because they're giving us more detail than ever before about this very dramatic event, which transformed, in fact, Mrs. Thatcher's political fortunes, leading to a sort of Falklands spirit, which she was then able to harness and, you know, in many ways contributed to the victory, the landslide victory in 1983 of the Conservative Party.
Simon, another aspect of the crisis that's significant was the United Kingdom's relationship with America, and particularly Mrs. Thatcher's personal relationship with Ronald Reagan. What can we learn from the files about that?
There are several strands of interest, I think, in the relationship between US and UK that come through in this file. And one is the personal relationship between Reagan and Thatcher. And that comes through in a number of ways. For example, at a time when the UK are really looking for assistance from the US, real proper support, Thatcher really wants to appeal to Reagan in a personal way, or at least in a way that she feels would get her results. And there's one letter written on the 5th of May 1982 where Thatcher writes to Reagan. She says that she's writing to him separately because I think you're the only person who will understand the significance of what I'm about to say. And she goes on to talk about these themes of peace and democracy and self-determination and liberty and justice and all these ideas that she really feels would get through to Reagan in a personal sense and really get her the support that she needed. And I think that's quite indicative of their relationship in that they understand each other in a way which seems to influence their kind of leadership of their two countries. It's not so one-sided, it's not so simple, and I think that's the thing that you do gain from seeing files like this, is that we might understand personal relationships, or at least, you know, the Reagan and Thatcher relationship, certainly, to be a quite simplistic one, that they got on well and they were always able to forge a strong relationship. But there were cracks in it, as far as I can see. I mean, throughout the Falklands crisis, you can sense that Americans are really trying to reach this negotiated settlement, that they're concerned about the potential of Soviet influence in Argentina if there's a vacuum of power. So while they're looking for this negotiated settlement right up until the end of the conflict, Thatcher really feels like she needs to press this point to Reagan that Britain hadn't taken all these risks just to negotiate with the Argentines in the end. She actually says this in a phone call, which is noted on the 31st of May. This is available in Prem 19/633. She says, "Britain had not lost precious lives in battle and sent an enormous task force to hand over the Queen's Islands," as she described them, immediately to a contact group. And she also appeals to Reagan again by saying, if such a thing had happened to Alaska, she would imagine that he would have behaved in exactly the same way. And that the kind of strains on a personal relationship between world leaders is shown in another file regarding the military dictatorship in Poland, which was imposed in December 1981, and that's in Prem 19/871. In that, we see a transcript of a phone call between Thatcher and her Foreign Secretary, Lord Carrington, where she describes a missive from Reagan as being so vague as she didn't bother to read it when it came in. And it's really interesting that she should use such language, because we assume them, as I was saying, as having a strong personal relationship that's formidable. But here we are seeing her describing Reagan as vague and finding some of his comments less than helpful.
As Marcus said, the Falklands crisis helped to transform Mrs. Thatcher's political fortunes. But at the start of that year, unemployment had reached 3 million. And obviously, the year before, we'd had urban riots in places around the country. What did the file show us about how the government attempted to tackle the problems within society?
Regarding unemployment, we can see that they were discussing specific ideas as to try and bring down the that high level of unemployment. And we see some of those ideas in a file called Prem 19/838. In that, we see that different cabinet ministers are offering their ideas to try and bring down the level of unemployment. We've got a very interesting document from the Central Policy Review staff, which details their reasoning or their ideas as to why there's such a high level of unemployment. But I feel that most interestingly of all in here is that Prime Minister Thatcher's lead economic advisor, Alan Walters, offers a great deal of advice here, often against what the Central Policy Review staff were offering their reasons to be. And it shows a very interesting schism, possibly a strong word, but an interesting disagreement within kind of the policy-making side of government. Ultimately, they're talking about this notion of a job release scheme, which is encouraging older members of the workforce to retire early so that youth who are unemployed can take up their jobs. And also talking about the introduction of the youth training scheme, which did go ahead, you know, and about whether civil service should be part of it. And I think Mark's right about this Falklands spirit idea. There's been previously written about how when various unions were talking about possible strike action and things like that, that Thatcher could point to this Falklands spirit and say, this is not how our country operates at this time. This doesn't fit in with what we do. And so I think that was something that she was able to capitalise on. And talking about your question regarding society and how this being the year after the urban riots, what was government doing about it? There's a very interesting document, Prem 19/783, which regards this so-called family policy group, which is essentially various members of the cabinet offering their ideas on society and how it can be improved, essentially. And it begins with Ferdinand Mount, who went on to write the 1983 Conservative Party manifesto. And he offers very interesting set of notions about more parent-led schools and the increased grammar of society he was talking about. He's talking about, you know, greater knowledge of English law, for example. He talks about vandals and delinquents. He talks about children's television, even, and says how it's lifeless, moralless, mindless and themeless, and that children's TV programmes reduce life to a meaningless buzz of chatter, which is quite a fascinating notion. But then we also hear other cabinet members' voices. We hear Geoffrey Howe talking about state paternalism as being one of the causes for this. We hear about Home Secretary Willie Whitelaw saying that school sports were important so that our teenagers unleash their physical energies through games rather than bricks and petrol bombs. And we hear about Keith Joseph bemoaning the sharply rising trend of irresponsible parents and thinks that there should be a television campaign on similar lines to kind of anti-smoking, advertising, essentially, to discourage underage pregnancy.
And do we learn anything else about the government's approach to economic policy in 1982?
Yes, well, we've got a whole set of files regarding economic policy, but in particular interest are those building up to the 1982 budget. Now, 1981's budget was particularly significant, and there was a great deal of debate around that, and there were leaks, and there was a lot of kind of cabinet recrimination at the time. And this file, Prem 19/701, begins with the potential investigation into another cabinet leak, 1982's budget. They decide to not investigate, feeling that might be unnecessary. But it's quite interesting that this kind of difficulty is continuing. But the economic advisor, Alan Walters, again, is playing a huge role here, clearly influencing Thatcher's ideas for the economy going forward. And they're talking about cutting the public spending borrowing requirement so that there could be a potential net tax reduction of up to £1.5 billion. And there's other interesting notions about presenting this budget in the House of Commons, and Prime Minister's press secretary is very interested in it, presenting it in a meaningful way. And the Prime Minister herself offers some interesting comments through her annotations on a fifth draft of the budget, criticising the speech for being too detailed and recommending that someone go through the speech to cut the detail by at least one third. I remember the House got very restless at last year's detail.
Mark, were there any other files that caught your eye in this year's release?
Yes, well, another file actually is all about Mark Thatcher's disappearance during the Paris to Dakar car rally in January 1982. He actually went missing for 6 days in the Sahara Desert. And this file, which is Prem 19/893, the reason it's so interesting is, again, I referred to the dramatic telegrams about the invasion of the Falkland Islands. Well, again, this file tells the story largely through telegrams, and there's all kinds of sightings of Mark Thatcher coming into the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, but these keep proving unreliable and they're contradicted by other messages. And, you know, this goes on for about 3 days, and, you know, there's a particular telegram from Lord Carrington which makes it clear that the Prime Minister is now most concerned since there has been no reliable information for 3 days. And so possible sightings continue. Little snippets of information come in, you know, from the last driver to see him and his party. There'd been some problem, the back axle of the car had broken and so forth. Eventually, Mark Thatcher and his party are found by an Algerian military aircraft. Mark Thatcher and co had set up a tent in the desert, and he's brought home to Britain safe and well. Now, the next thing that happens is that questions are asked by some in Parliament, querying the cost of the operation. Although Mark Thatcher had been found by an Algerian aircraft, nonetheless, the FCO had also been involved in the rescue effort, you know, and the kind of costs for this are given in the file. And there's a very telling annotation by Margaret Thatcher written in her own hand where she's saying the cost is £1,191, and Mrs. Thatcher is saying, "I must pay the £1,191. We can therefore say that no extra cost has fallen on the British taxpayer. To who do I make out the cheque?" And, you know, this shows Mrs. Thatcher's scrupulous attitude. It reminds me of a very interesting file which caused a lot of attention in the 1981 releases about the refurbishment of the flat above number 10 where she lived with Dennis, and the whole question then of, you know, she stated, "I will pay for the ironing board," she wrote three times in a file, you know, she was... So it's very interesting, and I think even after she's paid that cheque, which was made out to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, she was then requested to pay another £15, you know, and I think that was duly paid as well. It's just that kind of interesting insight into Mrs. Thatcher's values.
And is there a file, Mark, about someone else who's been in the news a lot recently, Jimmy Savile?
Yes, you're right. Yes, you're right, Tommy. There is a file about Jimmy Savile. And, of course, you know, interest is high in Jimmy Savile. It's a bit of a thin file in many ways. It's really... The reason the file exists, really, is because Jimmy Savile made a request to the Prime Minister. He was really asking about tax arrangements for charitable donations, you know, seeking relief on tax donations... charitable donations to the Stoke Mandeville Hospital. His particular query is sort of taken up. He writes a letter to Mrs. Thatcher. People will make their own conclusions, really, about the style and the content of that letter. But Mrs. Thatcher sends a holding reply. It's clear that, you know, he has a line of communication to Downing Street, but all the usual kind of niceties are observed by... the government. I mean, you know, they were obviously oblivious to anything else in the life of Jimmy Savile. He's also lobbying government, really, for a contribution from government. I think it's Year of the Disabled. And the Norman Fowler at the Department of Health and Social Security is happy to find some money. And the government gives a cheque of £500,000 to the cause to raise funds for the... I think it's the spinal injuries unit at Stoke Mandeville.
So, Simon, in conclusion, what are your overall impressions from 1982, from the files?
Well, I mean, as I said at the beginning, obviously this year was dominated by the Falklands conflict, and I feel like that's reflected in this year's file release. But what it does, in, you know, even on a subject that's been so well researched and has so many texts written about it, it does offer, you know, it does offer that extra bit of detail, that extra bit of official, you know, notation on history, I suppose, and does allow you to see these extra stories. But I mean, one example of where it does little more than just confirm what we already knew is in an issue like the sinking of the Belgrano. Now, this is a subject that's been so long discussed and so long researched and pontificated about. And what we see in the files is merely a confirmation of what we already knew, is that, you know, and that this, the rules of engagement, for example, were extended for Argentine naval vessels so that, for example, that Belgrano could be attacked. But, I mean, this is nothing new, really. But I think what we can come back to is this running refrain throughout a release such as this, that not only do we see extra details, not only do we hear about how upset Thatcher was about the possible sale of Exocet missiles, or how strained or otherwise the relationship was between Reagan and the Prime Minister, we just see that extra detail on history, which allows for a fuller picture than you would get from, you know, personal papers or from secondary sources, and that's why I find these releases fascinating.
Now, Mark, you might even remember 1982 from the first time round. How has your impressions changed looking at the files now, 30 years on?
Yes, well, of course, I very much agree with Simon, who summed it up admirably, really, that these files provide more detail than we've ever seen about this watershed event. You know, so we're getting a very full and rich picture from these records. And, you know, I think it's sort of seeing the events unfold. The files show you events unfolding in real time. And it really, when you look at these telegrams that I've been talking about, you know, they have a sort of sense of immediacy. It's very powerful. You know, you're transported back to that time. But, of course, with these files, you're on the inside track of government. So, you know, they do add a great deal to the whole sort of appreciation of what happened. You know, there really is the national record. Well, I'm just fascinated by these records. But coming back to your question, Tommy, yes, I can remember listening to the debate in the House of Commons on Saturday, the 3rd of April. Extremely rare for Parliament to be recalled on a Saturday. That was a very dramatic debate, and a debate in which Michael Foot, the leader of the opposition, you know, he stated, you know, whatever the rights and wrongs of, you know, should the government have done more to prevent the invasion, nonetheless, he gave his fulsome support to the whole idea of the whole proposal for a task force to set sail. It was a fascinating debate. And really, these files bring back to me just what a dramatic event it was. You know, Mrs. Thatcher's conviction, you know, sort of really does shine through from the records. And also, I think I picked up just how it was a closer-run thing, perhaps, than I thought. You know, I've picked up from looking at the files, you know, these factors to do with the winter closing in, you know, at a certain point. You know, there was only a fairly narrow window, you know, for Britain to send this force and to successfully retake the islands. And there was a number of factors where luck played a part. And so it does provoke quite a lot of thought, really, about the whole affair, yeah.
Great. Well, thank you, Mark and Simon. And some of the files that they've been talking about will be available via our website. That's www.nationalarchives.gov.uk from the 28th of December until the end of January. This podcast was recorded at the National Archives on the 18th of December 2012. This podcast is copyright National Archives. All rights reserved.